advice by having everything silly happen now. So I think that many, 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 many of us did not grow up with a very strong Jewish education, probably most of the people here. And I think that one of the subjects that we have had the worst miseducation on is the afterlife. Because most of the Jews who I meet say, oh, well, Jews don't believe in the afterlife. And then when I tell them, well, that's very far from true, and then they ask me, why do you think, though, then, that it's not discussed more often? I have my own theories. I'm curious to hear yours one day. But I think that the most important thing to understand when it comes to the afterlife is that Jews saying that Jews don't believe in an afterlife could not be further from the truth. And I think that, unfortunately, what is true is that it's not discussed enough and that it's not written about enough for reasons that you'll probably get into. But I think that every once in a while, we have pioneers of the generation who are willing to stand up and talk about things that other people don't talk about and write about things that other people don't write about. And I'm very proud to be a friend and a colleague and an admirer of yours. And I think that your book is a much needed contribution to this field, because I personally believe that the sad reality is that most people only think about the afterlife when they've lost someone. And when people don't believe in an afterlife and then you lose someone, God forbid, so then it's very scary and very depressing. And I think you're going to share with us how at a very young age this subject came to the forefront of your mind and how you've sort of made it your life mission to raise awareness of it. And we're very grateful and very appreciative that you came to speak to us about it.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
Thank you. So I'm not going to sit down.
If you get too hot, you can tell me.
Some
people were
here?
Cold. There's the, you could just turn the switch if you're
whatever,
too hot.
Whatever everybody else is comfortable with. I'm going to sort of move this up a little bit so we're not so separate from each other. That was quite the introduction. And you've chosen to come here tonight, so you know the topic. I'm not blindsiding you. It's not like you don't know where we're going with this. And I feel, as Gavura so eloquently introduced me, that I do have a little bit of a responsibility, given the life experiences I've had, to share the things that I found to be helpful with my own losses. And so I took it upon myself to learn more, to comfort myself in my grief of having lost a child when I was 26 years old. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a background, just my personal story and my personal journey towards where I am today. You know, it's interesting, the last two Torah portions that we just read about Jacob, our forefather, who was running away, the beginning last week, 2 weeks ago, Parshas Vayetze, he was running away from Be'er Sheva, from his home. And then last week's parsha we just read yesterday, he's coming back. And in two different scenarios, Jacob finds himself, he has an experience that changes his life. And perhaps we can all point to situations in our own lives where we have been changed by something pivotal, something that just made our lives, like it was a pivotal moment or a traumatic moment or something where we felt like it changed us. Obviously, we have gradual changes, but sometimes there's an abrupt change. So once upon a time, there was a young woman living in England, and she had a very blessed life. And she grew up, and she went to a posh private girls' school, and her parents were very loving, and she grew up in this beautiful home. It was a Jewish home, but it wasn't an educated Jewish home. And in her early 20s, she met an American who had come to England to serve in the U.S. Air Force as a doctor in the Air Force. He was Jewish. He was a doctor. He was, had all the accoutrements that one was attracted to. So that became my husband. And we got married in 1985, which now is almost 40 years ago. We got married and we moved to America. We moved to Washington, D.C. Very exciting. Great. This is the beginning of the next chapter of our lives. And we're going to live in Washington. And it's the hub, feeling like it was a hub of the world. We started our married life there. with the expectation that we would have a family and everything would be continue to be as rosy as it had been up until that point. A few years of infertility, we were blessed with a baby, and the baby we were blessed with had a lot of medical issues, which at the time, again, now Sam was born in 1989, so that is exactly 35 years ago, and he had different medical challenges that we didn't know the extent of, the biggest of which was a heart defect. And it necessitated after 4.5 months that he should go into open heart surgery and that he would be fixed. And I certainly had that feeling that he was going to be fixed. So we're going to deal with it. Whatever it is, we're going to deal with it. We handed Sam over to the medical team who were going to perform surgery on him. And we went to the waiting room and we waited in the waiting room. And we waited in the waiting room and we waited in the waiting room and we waited in the waiting room. And many, many hours later, the surgeon came out, started drawing pictures of Sam's heart. We're going to try this, we're going to try that. It wasn't what we expected. And he was, I don't know what he was doing. And I looked at him as he was concentrating on these pictures he was drawing. And I said, is Sam still alive? And I don't really know where that question came from. Is he still alive? And he couldn't answer the question. And I was 26, my husband was 32, 31, whatever. And that was not in the cards. That was not anything that we thought would be. I didn't think about it. It wasn't anything I was cognizant of even anticipating. So being able to experience that in all its enormity, not know how to be. You know, you don't have experiences to deal with stuff like that. So you break down, you scream, you don't know, you don't. So they had to move us out of the waiting room. There's other parents waiting for their children, and this crazy woman is screaming her head off. And we were removed to a side room, and then somehow we made it back home. And our community, which at the time, perhaps you're familiar, maybe not, there's a small Orthodox synagogue in Washington, D.C., in Georgetown called Kesher Israel. If you ever go to Kesher Israel, we have a plaque on the wall that we put up after Sam died in his memory. And I had the real honor of speaking there a couple of weeks ago. And there were people there that didn't know us, and there were people there that did know us, which was amazing. Still, 40 years later, some of the same people are still there. But there was a room full of people that didn't know us but knew the plaque. What's the story behind the plaque? And sometimes I think it reminds me of when we go to graves and we go to funerals and we hear the stories of the people's lives, and we're inspired by those people, and we hear what they put into the world, and we want to better ourselves because of who they were and what they represent. So they can be very inspiring. After Sam died, our community, as I said, took care of us in many, many different ways, some of which I describe in the book as a way to. And you have a beautiful Aish community, and I know you take care of each other. And it's such a blessing to have people to be with you, to people sit with you, to people to witness what you're going through. And that was huge. That was a huge source of comfort, was the people in our sphere, in our orbit. One of the women that came to Shiva, and we had known her for a few years prior to Sam being born and dying. So he literally lived for 4.5 months. But yet, and in my own mind, I had said, he's only 4 months old. Get over it. No, we all grieve differently, and we all have a lot of different experiences, and we need to give ourselves permission to feel the feelings we're feeling. And my friend came to me and she said, I want this to be comforting to you. I want you to know that a group of women in our community, I gathered them together and we prepared Sam for burial. We created what was an ad hoc, Chevra Kedisha, Holy Society. I was thinking about that term, Chevra Kedisha, Holy Society. And I was thinking, really, we're all holy. We as people who are a composite of a body, physical, organic body, and a holy breath of God. The word for soul in Hebrew is a neshama, which comes from the root neshima, breath, the breath of God. So we are a soul, a holy soul that's being breathed into a physical body. So we're all holy. But the work we do is holy. I would say all people are holy. And then how you manifest that is where you manifest this partnership with God. So these people washed Sam. They took care of him. They prepared him for burial, which I didn't know anything about. I am really going to pass out if you don't turn the heat down. So I am actually going to...
Sorry.
The button. Do you mind?
No.
Not at all.
What do I do with it?
Turn it down. Turn it off.
Okay, tell me if you get cold and we'll turn it back on. Oof. interesting. There's a term for the Chevra Kedisha. It's called Chesed Shel Emes, or Chesed Shel Emet. Truth, right? Emet is truth. And many times that phrase, Chesed Shel Emes, is referring to the way in which people, living people, take care of the dead. Because the dead can't thank us for the work we do for them. And whatever that is, whether that's going to a funeral and accompanying them in the burial and filling in the grave and being on the Chevra Kedisha and sitting guard with the body, there's a tradition to do that, Shmirah, sitting with God. I would say that that's all Chesed Shel Emes. That's kind of the term. There's another way to understand that. And a lot of the teachings that I'd like to share with you this evening are ones that I've recently learned that come from a seminal text that is a Kabbalistic text. It's very hard to learn from. And we have a teacher in Jerusalem who's teaching some women who are engaged with this work, some of the teachings from this book. It's called the Ma'ava Yabok. And it's a Kabbalistic text written in the 1600s by a Kabbalist in Italy. And that's where our customs come from. And they're pretty similar across the world, what people do. There's lots of local customs, but the main bulk of it comes from that book. So the Ma'ava Yabok says, and I'd like to come back to the title of that book in a second. The Ma'ava Yabok says that if you look at the word emet, so it has an aleph as the first letter, and an aleph is our godly soul that's being breathed into us, the spiritual aspect of us. And the next two letters spell the word met, or mace, which is the word we use for a body, a dead body. So if you think about aleph with a mace, that's us. All of us are a composite of a blown-in holy soul from God, divine, sourced back, connected to, always connected to the divine, that's blowing that soul into our physical body all the time. So any kindness we do, says the Ma'ava Yabok, any kindness that we do, living people, is emes, chesed shel emes. So just another take on that term, which I find very, it's equalizing, you know, because some people say, oh, yeah, I couldn't do that. There's a lot of other things people can do that other people can't do. So we're all working and trying to do chesed, and it's all emes because we are a composite of soul and body. This book, the Ma'ava Yabok, is named after the river that we read about also yesterday in yesterday's Torah portion. I don't know if you read it, but I'll just quickly synopsize it, that Jacob, our forefather, is going back home. After he left Beersheba, I think 20-something years ago, and he's going back. And he's going with his family, he's going with his children and his wives and his whole entourage. He's going back, and he realizes he forgot something. And he goes back across the Yabok River. That's the only place in the Torah we read about the Yabok River. And this book is from that, this crossing over, the idea that death is a crossing over. We don't end, and like Gevurah mentioned, said, you know, many people many Jewish people don't have an understanding that there is a lot in our teachings, not the written Torah, but in the oral Torah, there's a lot about the afterlife. So we're crossing over. We don't die, meaning end. We just change form. So life being a coupling, a miraculous, God-given, infused coupling of a body and soul, life, death is an uncoupling. The soul starts to disengage from the body that has housed it for its entire life. That's what we call death. And it doesn't happen all at once. It happens in stages, says our mystical tradition. So here I am, I'm like mourning Sam. I didn't know anything. Didn't understand where Sam had gone. I'd taken care of him in life. I wanted to take care of him. I wanted to know he was all right. If you're people in this room and you have children, you're blessed with children, I imagine when they go somewhere, you want to know, where are they going? Are they taken care of? Do they have enough clothing? Are they going to get food? Are they going to be comfortable? Do they have a bed to sleep in? All the things that we, if we're blessed to be parents, worry, or other relationships that we have, we worry that our loved ones are okay if we're not there to take care of them. And that was a very burning drive of mine when Sam died. I wanted to know, where did he go and was he okay? Because I couldn't take care of him anymore, even though I wanted to. And there began my journey to try to understand more and learn more. And I caveat with learning more has been comforting, and yet there's still grief. Grief is the opposite, the other side of the love coin. The love we have for our people in our lives, when they die, we miss them and we love them and we mourn them. And that is not, I'm not mitigating that. That's what makes us human. That's who we are. We're people who mourn losses. And if we have a little bit more knowledge about what happens with death and what death is, maybe that can add a layer of comfort to the equation. So I wanted to know more. And the rabbi at the time, and again, I think when you first lose a child like that, it was so sudden and it was so traumatic. I didn't have a head for anything. I couldn't hear any wisdom that was coming my way other than this friend telling me that she had taken care of Sam. It's like, what did you do? Could you please tell me, what did you do? And I don't know if she told me. I didn't really process it, as I mentioned. But many years later, I really wanted to know. And I've learned a lot and I've engaged in that mitzvah myself. To such a degree that it's sort of, I get very animated when I talk about it, because it's such a holy thing that Jewish people do for each other, and it's so not known. And we're in a world, America for sure, where when we lose our loved ones, our Jewish loved ones, we don't know what to do. We don't know, well, what shall I do? We don't have the knowledge. We don't have the foundation to tell us, okay, this is what's happening now. The soul is disengaging. We're now in a quote-unquote sort of a little bit of a rush to get the body planted into the ground. We want to bury our loved ones because that's where they belong now. They belong in the ground. And the soul, which has been in this body for its lifetime, whether it's 4 months or it's 120 years, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's reached, other than Moshe Rabbeinu, who didn't meet, but 100 years, 120 years, however many years we get to be locked in body and soul, our body, it becomes holy. It absorbs holiness, like a Sefer Torah, like a mezuzah case, like the boxes of the tefillin. They house the holy words of the Torah that come from God. So our body is like a Sefer Torah, and we are very, very respectful of it. And the beginning of the journey of the soul post-life, that soul is waiting for the body to be buried in order to allow it to ascend into the heavenly realms. So that's one of the reasons why we want to bury people. Do you want to ask a question or keep going? That's one of the, please feel free to ask questions as we go, or to we can come back to things. But that's the nature of perhaps this urgency to bury people. And in Israel, they can even do it within a few hours of somebody being dying. They bury people literally right away. Again, the soul is hovering. The soul is aware. The soul wants to know what's happening to its body. The soul is comforted by our presence. So Chevra Kadisha, walk into this space. We walk into this space. We have our beloved. So in our tradition, women are preparing women and men are preparing men. And that's modesty and the dignity and the respect that we have for the deceased, is that's how it's set up. We have women teams and men teams, and the women take care of the women, men take care of the men. So we walk into this space where there is an uncoupling of body and soul. And I've started teaching, we started talking to Chevra Kadisha women, some of whom are like, we're just on do mode, action mode, not in thinking mode. And this Rebbetzin in Israel is saying, Chevra Kadisha women, if you would like, I'd like to help you with your intentions. with your kavana, with the way in which you think about what you're doing. And this is all from this Kabbalistic text called the Ma'avah Yobok. That's all where it comes from. So we walk in, there's a soul and body, disembodied soul, aware of what's going on, that we learn is comforted by the presence of people, by the Chevra Kedisha, by the Shomer, by the person who's guarding the body. And then there's other things that we do. We cover the body. The body's always covered with a sheet, usually. There's always a candle burning. And these are things that I see because I go into lots of funeral homes. Doesn't happen to non-Jewish people. Non-Jewish people are not afforded the same kinds of care than what Jews are afforded.
Is it automatic or do you ask for it? I remember them asking us for the shomer, because you have to pay extra for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not automatic here.
It's automatic to cover them.
No, what about the
I'm saying if
the
you
washing?
Want, it's called a tahara.
Mm-hmm. To get the services of the chevetish, you have to ask. So that's why I'm on a mission.
Asked.
I
think
we
have to ask
shomer.
For it.
I remember we were asked about the shomer, and we said yes, but I don't remember about the washing.
That maybe the specifics of what happens in this particular community, we need to find out more about. But I'm traveling now around.
Unless
and
they
I,
just knew we weren't Orthodox. Like
No. So here's two. Well, again, I do you want to answer the question about what happens here,
Lisa? Here.
I'm just going to introduce, you don't need Adam. Afterwards, you can have up close and personal with the director of our local Chevra Kedisha.
They don't always ask, and they really should. So it's something we're working on that they should ask. They're supposed to ask.
I think when they ask.
Like
even
West Laurel,
it's
a problem.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, again,
all over the country, it's different.
Yeah.
It's different in different parts of the
world,
and it's different in different parts of the country. I can tell you, in Rhode Island, the Jewish cemetery requires our services in order to bury anyone in the Jewish cemetery. It's required by the cemetery.
Wow.
So I don't
no
even think
whether they're reform or
no.
affiliated.
Whatever you are, if you have tattoos, if you are transgender, if you are. Whatever you think might be a reason why you don't qualify to have a kosher burial, that's all myth. I want to say that right firmly now. I've been around the country already talking, and people ask me. Pretty much everybody in a non-religious crowd asks me whether if a tattoo is a problem. Not a problem at all.
Not at all.
So these are all myths. Actually, somebody said, I didn't know Orthodox women pierce their ears, which I didn't know people thought that Orthodox people don't pierce their ears. I didn't even know that one. No, but we're trying to break down the barriers between people and say, this is a kosher burial. I'm telling you what a kosher burial is. And it would be great if the cemetery would say, we're only going to bury people who get the tahara. And then it's out of your hands. You don't have to rely on the funeral director. It is the standard of the cemetery. So we can ask later more specifics later. But let me just kind of continue with this outline, because what I want this talk to be is a light on the love that exists between us. You know, our lives are a gift, and I would posit to say that death is a gift. So I'll come back to that a little bit. And the way in which we take care of each other, take care of the mourners, take care of the deceased, it's love. Somebody said to me, this is a love story. And I thought she was talking about me and my husband, which it is. And a love story between a mother and a child, which it is. But it's a love story amongst us, the Jewish people. And we walk in, maybe we don't know the lady on the table. Maybe we do. But if we don't, it doesn't change what we do. And it doesn't change our intentions. And it doesn't change what we want to bring. This will be the only interaction this deceased will have with the Chevra Kedisha, ever. This, right now. We might be going and doing another one in an hour or the next day. But this lady, this baby, this sister, this child, whoever they are, this is their one and only washing and preparation that they will get. And we and the Chevra Kedisha are very aware of that. And we are very aware of not operating from a place of roteness. We don't get used to it. It jars us. Every single time you walk in, you take a breath, you walk in, please God help me, And the first thing we do, act of love, please, dear sister, we use her name if we have her name. Hopefully we have a name. Could be an English name, a Hebrew name. Please forgive us for anything we are about to do that will disgrace you or dishonor you or disrespect you or anything that we may do. It's not our intention. Please know we are here to take care of you in the best of our abilities. And the first thing we do is ask her for forgiveness. As an emphasis on, this is a real person here, a body-soul combination in its process of disengagement, and we're aware of it, and we use the name, or we think the name over and over and over again. Sidebar, in Israel, there's a lot of Chevra Kedisha, obviously since October 7th, a lot. And we have in the organization I work for a community of women who are on Chevra Kedisha all over the world. So the head of the IDF, so the IDF has their own Chevra Kedisha. They have a Chevra Kedisha for women, a Chevra Kedisha for men, and they prepare and take care of their chayalim, their soldiers. Noah Lewis is the head of the women's division. And she spoke to our community because we wanted to support her, we wanted to help her. There were women in Israel who couldn't go to her base because you have to be in the army to be on her team, but we were able to go to the civilian center and help. There were women, as you know, it was right after Sukkot, right? It was right after the holiday, and there were Chevra Kedisha women from our community who were in Israel on holiday, for the holiday, and when it was obvious that we needed a lot of help, they weren't having enough people. We were able to mobilize some of the ladies that were on holiday, so to speak, in Israel to go down to the, there's a base in Rishon LeZion, and help the Chevra Kedisha there. So Noah Lewis was telling us that you only start your work when you have a name and an identity. The people had to be identified, which was a process, apparently, a difficult process for many of the holy people that were murdered and slaughtered, as you know. But she said, when I got the name and I now had this woman in my care, we would use the name over and over and over again, using the name as a love. When we use our names, sometimes it can be overused. You know, when you call the Dell computer guy and he uses your name and you don't want him to. But in this space, it's used as a connector. I'm using your name because I see you and I love you and I want to infuse into this space the commensurate amount of love into this space, opposite to the negative, evil emotion, you know, that went into why you're here. And I, Noah Lewis, and my team are bringing, hopefully we can have this overflowing love. And we said, oh, how do you do this? She said, this place was Gan Eden. It was like the Garden of Eden. She said, what we were doing was we weren't doing it from our minds. We were doing it from our souls. It was a soul work. And we were using their names and we were loving them. And we were imagining that we're in the Garden of Eden. Like such a reframe. Like, what a people we are, you know? So true. It's humbling. So first thing we do is we ask forgiveness and we use the name. And then we talk about our intention. And again, different communities have different customs. And some communities say different wording, different phrases that come from the Torah, come from a book called the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, or come from the prophets. There's variation in what people say in different Chevra Kedisha. So I'm using my own experience and what we say in Providence, Rhode Island. So it might not be what's said in this particular community, but the idea of saying the words is not just to say the words. It's to think about what we're doing. So the words are to inform us of where our thinking should be focused. So you don't necessarily need the words, you need the intention if you can. So what's the intention? The intention is, we say, a phrase that comes from a prophet called Zechariah. I have a grandson called Zechariah, but people in Atlanta used to call him Zechariah, but it's Zechariah. So the prophet Zechariah, he has an encounter with the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, in the time of the Second Temple. And the Kohen Gadol had been taken to task for some of the sins of his sons, and he had done complete teshuvah. He had like completely erased any responsibility that he had, and he was clean. And Zechariah, the prophet, says, you, Kohen Gadol, high priest, are going to shed the garments, the soiled, dirty, feces-encrusted garments. You're going to take those off, and you will be clothed in shiny white garments, pure, shiny white garments. And that's what we do. We take the clothing, we clean the body, we clean off all the dirt. And again, the Kabbalists say that cleaning the dirt, yes, it takes us to how we were at birth, right? We were born and we're washed and we're clean and we come into the world, we go out the same way. And the Kabbalistic teachings tell us that the soul is allowed to be released by the cleaning of the dirt. The dirt holds it back. Which, when I learned that, it made me feel like even more careful, like make sure I take every bit of dirt, the nails and the lipstick and any kind of other schmutz there might be on the body, make sure you get it off, you know, however you're going to do it, because we want the soul to be released. That's the intention. We're going to do that next. That's the next
piece.
Oh,
because you're doing the same.
Oh, like the mikvah. Right. We're removing everything there. Yeah, right. But the teaching that the soul gets released by the removal of the dirt was a new thing. I didn't know that, and I've been talking now to Chavim Kedishim, and they also didn't know it. So I think feel like it's sort of helping us in our intentions to have that as a understanding of what's going on. You know, it's like when you light Shabbos candles. You can light Shabbos candles, and it can be beautiful, and you like the light in the room. But if you have a sense of, you know, bringing the holiness and other things that you can think about that's happening around you in that space where it all looks the same, but there's something spiritual and mystical happening around you. So we're trying to tap into that if we can. So the cleaning is what is helping to release the soul from its physical tethered body. And then we put the body through a mikvah. So in some communities, they literally have a mikvah. And other communities, it's more of a pouring of water. A certain amount of water has to be poured. And again, we say sentences, phrases, verses that come from various prophets that attest to God promising that he will bring a complete cleansing and a complete purification with a little bit of water. That the water that was at the beginning of time. There's no new water. We're not creating any new water. At the beginning of the book of Genesis, God's presence hovered over the surface of the water. There was water and God, and then God separates the water, etc. But this water represents kindness and love and knowledge of God and all different things that water represents. You know, obviously it's the universal solvent and it's all the other things, but it's such a miraculous entity, and we use water, and God says, you pour the water, you sprinkle the water, and I will bring purity, I will bring cleanliness, I will bring complete purification. Wow. And then, like the mikveh, if anybody goes to the mikveh, if anybody's been to the mikveh lady will say, you are kosher, and they'll say, kosher, 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 you're clean, 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 you're good to go, no problem. So we, some of us in some communities, in our community, when we've poured the water, we say, Tahorahi, Tahorahi, you are pure, you are pure, you are pure. And it says a bus call, a heavenly voice comes down and declares the woman in our care pure. Wow. And then we'll dry her. And then we'll dress her in clothing that is fit for the occasion. What's the occasion? The occasion is, we're getting you ready, not for death, says the Ma'avah Yobok. We're not getting you ready for death. We're getting ready for life. Because this temporary separation of your body and soul entity that we are in life, the separation of the two is temporary. Traditional Jewish teachings is that there will be a day in the future when the purified body and the purified soul will rejoin at the time of the Tachiyas HaMesim, of the resurrection of the dead. That is a classic Jewish teaching, and it's in our prayers. We say it in the Amidah 3 times a day, that God is faithful to the dead and will revive the dead. And we think, I have no idea what that is. Right? We have no idea what that is. And God puts into our world examples of radical transformation so that we actually have examples of things that happen that perhaps can give us an inkling of what that might be. So here's 2 examples. One is a caterpillar goes into a pupa as a caterpillar. It dissolves and becomes like a, I don't know what it looks like inside a pupa. And then what comes out? A butterfly. That's unbelievable. It went from a caterpillar to a butterfly. And how is that even possible? Because God made it happen, right? So that's in our world. We see that. We don't bat an eyelid necessarily. But it's a radical transformation from one way, one form to another form. You take a seed, and I've done this. You take a tomato seed and you put it in the ground. And you water it and you wait and you water it. And it sort of disappears until it sprouts and it grows and it becomes a tomato plant. Again, a radical transformation. So this idea of planting seeds or a caterpillar are examples of radical transformation that can help us allow there to be a planting of the body in the ground, a journey of the soul into the world of souls. So they both go through their own purification process until that time where they'll come back together at the end of days and bask in divine light for all eternity. It says in the Mishnah, in the Ethics of the Fathers, that we all have a place in the world to come. So we all have to go through our separate, each part of us goes through a separate journey for that. So the journey of the body is to go into the ground and to become one with the ground. Somebody asked me if we could, she asked me, can we dispose of our body with composting? Because apparently that's a new thing that's being offered to people, is to compost your body. But she used the word dispose of your body. And again, it gets back to the reverence and the holiness that we treat the body. It's not a body that we dispose of. It's a vessel that we take care of and we recognize as holy, as a Sefer Torah is holy. So we don't dispose of Sefer Torahs, we bury Sefer Torahs. Mm-hmm. Did you have a question?
I'm just fascinated by what you said about at the end of days, the yep. body will come back with this. That is what we...
Purified body and soul. It's not going to be like you get reconstituted as you are now and you will look the same, you know, like the knee bone and the thigh bone, and you get up and you start walking again. It's that it's almost like, this is the way I think about it, is when Adam and Eve were created at the beginning of Genesis, they were created in the Garden of Eden. And the tradition teaches, the mystics teach, that they were mostly soul with a wisp of body. So again, that Adam could see from one end of the world to the other, that Adam was, you know, had his head in the heavens. Not like we, like us. A huge soul with a wisp of a body. And that when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, everything shifted. And death came into the world, and a change in the nature of people changed. So the soul went in, and the body became thickened, like us, right? So our soul comes out through our eyes and maybe our hands. That's how we see. That's why we look into each other's eyes, to see the essence of a person's in there. Like, that's where it's coming out, through the eyes, which is why we close the eyes of the dead, by the way. That's the first thing I do, is like, sure, the eyes are closed. The eyes are closed because there's nothing coming from the inside out. There's no soul emanating out from the inside anymore. And we want the nifteris, we want that soul not to be looking like into the spiritual world. So we close the eyes of the dead. There's nothing coming out from there anymore. So your question is, when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, before they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they were a different composite of body and soul. They were mostly soul with a wisp of body, and then that shifted. So we have a body that we call hide, right? Your skin is your hide because it hides your soul. So when we've gone through this purification process, We're going to be more like Adam. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay, we can keep talking.
Fascinating,
it's fascinating, right? Yes, please.
So at some point they...
But they'll come back together at the end of days, after the resurrection, right? So the resurrection after the Messiah comes, when there's... And there'll be no more death. We'll be done with death. And this temporary separation of body and soul will be over. And the temporary... And the separation of the living from the dead is temporary. So I found that very comforting. Yes, I miss Sam. And yes, I wish he had lived. And yes, all the things. And it's temporary.
Oh, wow.
Yes, please.
I was going to step back to the cleaning of the dirt. Is there a much deeper meaning behind that? I'm assuming there must be.
Deeper meaning to taking the dirt off?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I think I gave what I think is the deep meaning, that the dirt is an anchor, and we need to release that, the soul, from the physicality that encases it. And if you go to that prophet, that statement from the prophet that says, I'm going to take this high priest and I'm going to take his soiled garments, I'm going to get rid of those garments and put on shiny white garments. And even Jacob in yesterday's Torah portion has a process where he goes into, he purifies himself and he changes his clothes. So, and death is a changing of clothes. The garment is that we, Rabbi Nachman says that our body is like a garment that is encasing and closing and holding the soul. So death is a taking off the garment. Rabbi Nachman says, I want to shed this body that is the garment so that my soul can ascend into the higher realms. Right? And he goes on to say that when the soul is brought out of the world of souls to be born, because it has a job to do in this world, when that soul is beginning to lock into a physical body in the mother's womb and then gets born and then lives and then dies. So what happens as it's coming in, it doesn't want to leave this spiritual, sublime, beautiful existence. And the soul is crying. The angels are crying when the soul's born. The people are happy. Mazel tov. Yay, baby. And what happens at the other end, it's the reverse. It's the opposite. The people are crying and the soul's happy to go back into the spiritual realms. And we spoke about the Chevek Adisha coming in, bringing the divine presence with us. And there's a teaching, again, Marvaya Bach, mystical teaching, that our soul, as it exits this world, is greeted by the divine presence, which jives with near-death experiences. When people talk about seeing light and feeling love and wanting to go towards it, and then they're sucked back into this world that they didn't want to come back to, that jives with this teaching. This mystical teaching that the divine presence comes to welcome, and then your relatives come to welcome you. Sometimes people before they're dying, when they're in that, you know, obviously they don't die suddenly. If people die more gradually, that maybe you've heard or you've seen people dying, they'll start talking to their relatives in languages like Russian or German or Yiddish or whatever they speak, and they see their relatives. Because that's in our tradition, that they are the relatives, the deceased relatives, come to greet them.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
If the body is a vessel that houses our like vibrant living soul, and at death it disengages and goes up to the heavens, I'm just curious about this, and I never heard anything about it. I find it curious that people go to graveyards and talk to
yeah.
the body.
Yeah.
Like, where
no, they're not talking to the body.
From?
They're not talking to the body.
Why don't we just
yes.
look up wherever we are? Like,
right.
What is that?
Right.
Where did it start and why did people
nice.
Do it?
That's a good question. So the burial, so get back to the Techiyas HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead. So that is one of the reasons why it's given that we should be buried. And that lower aspect. So the soul, I'll give you a parable about how to perhaps understand the soul. And this is from a text called The Bridge of Life. It's again a very seminal text that Chevek Adisha and people who are interested in this topic, they read this book. It's a great book. It's called The Bridge of Life. And the story given there is about God as a glass blower, so to speak. A blower of glass. Glass. So you have a pipette. And like the glass blower blows into the pipette and the air goes through the pipette into the blob of glass at the end, and it animates and it infuses that blob with with air, with life. So God's the blower, and then we have different levels of soul. The lower aspects of the soul we call the nefesh. And that's the life force, the animal life source that animates us, that we're hungry and we're thirsty and we're tired and, you know, all the things that make us sort of like animals. We're not animals, but that we have that in common with animals. That's the lower aspects of the soul. It's called the nefesh. And then the next level is the ruach. And the next level is the neshama. And you go up till you get to the source. So it's all connected like a string. So the understanding is that the lower aspects of the soul stay near the grave. So we go to graves of our relatives, of holy people, people who've achieved a lot of spirituality in their lives, or people who loved us, or whoever, we go to graves. And we don't pray to them. We ask them to take our prayers up for us. Take our prayer up to God for me. One would be one reason why you would go to a grave. And then the second reason I'll offer, amongst many, is that in the merit of the person buried here, all the good that this person did, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, or Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Vilea, we go to all our forefathers and all our foremothers and all the holy people, we go to their graves and we, in their merit, please God, in their merit, I am descended from these people, answer my prayers in the way I want them answered.
I don't think most people go to graveyards for prayers. I think
you should go to the Lubavitcher Rebbe's ohel in his grave in Queens, New York. It is packed always with all sorts of people, not just his Lubavitch followers. Yeah, it's fascinating. And if you go to Israel, it's quite common, certainly on some Israel trips, to go to the grave of Rachel, our foremother, or in Tiberias to go to the Ramban. It's a thing.
Yeah, in general.
I mean, and actually, I heard from Rabbi Tatz that the soul comes closer to its grave, to its where it's planted, in the month of Elul, which is the month before Rosh Hashanah, and on a Yahrzeit. So maybe that's where that custom to go at those times of year specifically, because the lower aspects of the soul, because the soul is more present at that time, at the grave, right? So where are we? Okay, so we're putting the garments. I'm not watching the time, so...
Yeah, so what garments do you put on?
Yes, I'm about to tell you. Thank you for asking that.
You don't put, like, suits and clothes.
No, we don't put suits on. All right, so if you say, like, I want to be dressed for the occasion, right? So what's the occasion? The occasion is an intimate encounter with the divine. The soul is leaving its body to have an intimate encounter with the divine. In our world, the person who had the most intimate encounter with the divine was the high priest on Yom Kippur in the Holy Temple, who went into the Holy of Holies. That's for a regular person, that's about as close to having an intimate encounter that any of us could hope for. So the garments that the high priest on Yom Kippur wore in the Holy Temple to greet and to be in the Holy of Holies was five white linen garments. That's what we dress the deceased in.
So a man would be buried in his kittel?
So I'll just go through it. So we have a pair of pants. Women are buried in pants also. And most communities, not all, it's like a booty. It's like, you know, children's pajamas where it's closed at the bottom. Because you're not getting up and walking anymore. So it's a pair of pants, and for women, we tie a string around the under the knee just to make it not regular pants. I don't know if men do that. Actually, I don't know if men do that. Shall find out. And then we have two tunics, the outer of which has a collar. For women, we have a bonnet and a veil. So we want to keep the face covered. It's not respectful to look into the face of the dead, so we don't do that unless we're washing the face. So we keep everything covered. And the last garment is a girdle that goes around. So the kittel would be like that tunic. the gantle that goes around in Providence, Rhode Island, and again, there's minhagim customs that change in different locations, but the minhag in our community is we take this gantle and we bring it around and then we twist it 13 times. And I learned that the reason we do it 13 times is that 13 is a number of the divine attributes of kindness of God. 13 divine attributes of God. And it's what we say over and over and over again on Yom Kippur. We say it over and over again. 13. When Moses, our teacher, when Moses died, God buried him. We don't know where he's buried, but God buried him. And it says in the Torah, in Deuteronomy, it says that he was buried in the valley. And the word for valley is Gai, which is spelled with two Hebrew letters, a Gimel and a Yud. Gimel and Yud have a numerical value. Gimel is the third letter and a Yud is a tenth letter. 10 and 3 is 13. So the understanding is that God buried Moses in the highest place, so to speak, of divine kindness and goodness and forgiveness and all those things. And that's our intention, that this lady in our care, we're bringing her to that 13 level of high attributes of God. That's what our intention is. So we do it 13 times. And that's the thinking. I wanted to go back a little bit with the washing, because you asked about washing. That the washing we do it in a precise order. And it's done Kabbalistically, that the head is the most refined part of our body. That the head is the highest and the most spiritual and the most transcendent and the one that has our thoughts and the one that we is unparalleled in any other creation is our head. So we're very careful with the head. We hold the head and we're respectful that it doesn't flop around and we make sure we hold on to it, that it's taken care of lovingly. So wash the head first and then we wash the right arm. Go down the right side of the body. Because right is chesed, right is kindness. It's all sphera. It's all different divine attributes that our body that is created in the image of God, B'Tselem Elokim, our body is an image of God. So each body part has a potential to be used in good and holy ways. Hopefully we did that. And if we didn't, we have a way to make up for it. So the Chevra Kedisha, as we wash each body part, we have in mind that this is, that we're washing this head that was only used for good thinking and the eyes were only used for good seeing and the mouth was only used for good talking and the ears only heard good things and the hands only went to do good and your torso was like compassionate and filled with grace and the legs ran to do good. All the things that we have the potential to do, we imagine that this lady in our care did those things. This is a holy B'Tselem Elokim, a vessel created in the divine image that we're taking care of. And we're very aware of it. And we're very humbled by it. And we do everything we do in silence. Because we want to be like focused. This is the one Tahara this lady's going to get. So we want to do the best job we can. So we dress our beloved sister in her burial shrouds, which is the right dress for the occasion. And then we wrap her in a sheet. And the sheet is very interesting that the word for the burial shrouds we call is tefachim. And where that appears in the Torah is in the book of Esther, in the Megillah of Esther, actually, you know, in the scroll of Esther, and we read on Purim, that Mordechai wore tefachim. That there are binding. It's something about binding, that closer. There's a close that sort of hold this entity tight for a new creation that's going to happen in the future. So there's a tradition that says that when God started to create the world, maybe you've heard this, he created a world and he destroyed a world, created a world, destroyed a world, created a world, destroyed a world, till he created this world. So on some level, this person in our care is an iteration of a creation that needed to be disassembled and needs to be bound and ready for the next leg. So it's a similar kind of like we're binding and we're enclosing it and we're keeping it secret and we're putting it into a coffin, but it's not a coffin because a coffin in Hebrew is an aron. It's an ark. It's a holy ark. Again, the outside terms don't fit the holiness of what we're doing. We take our Sefer Torah / woman in our care and we put it in an Aron. It's so beautiful. And ideally, if you're buried in Israel's land, the land itself has divine properties to it, which bring about cleansing and healing and atonement. So if you're not buried in Israel, and there are many reasons why you are not buried in Israel, then we bring Israel to you. We have packets of sand from Israel that we put on your body, that we sprinkle on the body of the deceased, so that you get the... They say that if you're buried in Israel, it's as if you're buried in your mother's bosom. If you're buried in this holy place, under the holy altar, whatever, all these terms that are used. So we bring that to you, to America, to England, to wherever. We bring that land and we put it in our community. We put it on the eyes and we put it on the heart. These are places that maybe you're led astray, so we put them on those places, and that's another supreme act of kindness. And it says in the Torah that God will atone. God will help us. God will help us. We all have a place. We're all going to be taken care of. And when we wrap and we put in the Aron, in the Torah, we read about the tabernacle in the desert, right? There's the tabernacle, and when the clouds started to move, the Jews would take down their tabernacle, and then they would move, and then they would set it back up again, right? We traveled in the desert for 40 years. So we use some of those same verses from the Torah about moving and about taking the holy vessels, so not the holy vessels from the tabernacle, but the holy vessel that is the body. And we treat it like the holy vessels that were in the tabernacle. We're not going to look at them. We're going to be very respectful. We're going to say certain verses that come from the same passages about moving the tabernacle, moving the Mishkan. So everything's elevated and everything is careful and orchestrated and infused with love. And then we say sorry again at the end. We ask for forgiveness if we did anything we didn't wasn't right or whatever. It's not always that we take care of clean and old people. You know, we take care of people who've had different kinds of ends to their lives, but it's all the same. It's done the same way. So I can keep talking, but I don't know that I want to, because I'd like to include you more if you'd like to ask a question, if you have more questions. At the end of the day, knowing some of this has helped me in my own losses. And when I share it with people, it's helped them. Not that it takes away your grief, because grief is the love expressed. And we should give it, I believe that having permission to grieve is something maybe our Jewish community needs to work on a little bit. And understanding what happens when we die can be an important aspect of our Jewish education, so that we are not as frightened of it. We say that what you can name, you can tame. And if we don't talk about death, it becomes even more, excuse the pun, shrouded in mystery. And if we do talk about it, not that it takes us into, you know, stops us from living, but it informs our life. I only have a short amount of time in this world till I go into the next world. What am I doing with my time? How am I spending my time? What am I doing? How do I take care of other people? How do I take care of myself? You know, so it can affirm our lives knowing about death versus it being this scary thing that I don't want to talk about and I don't want to ever encounter. That's not the reality of our world. So please ask some questions or thoughts or...
Yeah, I feel like I didn't do it right for my parents. And like, is it okay? Like, they're still going to have a place in the
yes.
world to come. And
yes.
you know, I know that all that, but I just,
yes.
I feel like these are things that, like you said, I wish we were told. But I can't say that they didn't tell us, because you're sitting there grieving.
Yes, that's why we want to talk about
you're
now.
You're going through the checklist and you don't know what to... We want this and we want that, and
you don't know.
Right, you don't know. And
now, you know, now we know to ask.
But it is offered by our Jewish funeral homes, or we don't know?
I don't know in this area. This area, I'm sorry, I'm going to put you on the spot here. I don't know what happens in this particular community, but I would say that knowing that this is a tradition that we do, right? So let's talk about it. When you encounter it in your own life or in your friend's life or in your community member's life or anybody, now we can put into the world that this is Jewish burial.
Yeah.
And if all we know is perhaps what the outside world is teaching us, we don't know what this is. And if you do know about this, then you can make an informed decision what you choose.
Or just tell your children that you want a kosher burial and they have to do whatever that means.
What I experience a lot, and I mean you can speak to this as well, but what I experience a lot, every time Benjamin and I know someone who passes away, we try, you know, who's close to us, we try in the most gentle way to, like, suggest that it be kosher. And usually the response about, I don't want to say a percentage, but a lot, people say to us,
yes,
well, my family member wasn't Orthodox.
Right.
So I don't need to do it the Orthodox way. And my husband will try it, you know, and it's obviously very sensitive. This is a very sensitive time in someone's life.
Right.
This is not the time usually to have the conversation.
But it's when it comes up.
And like a colleague of ours, Robin Meyerson, really, I would love to bring her here to speak because she speaks a lot about cremation. I have grandparents who are cremated. Most Jewish people I know do. Because when someone dies, they usually say, well, I want to respect the deceased's wishes, and this is what they wanted. And so I have tried to say, well, now their soul is with God, and this really is what their soul wants. But it's usually too late at that point.
I think there's two different angles to this conversation. But the angle I want to come at this conversation with is to promote burial. And to talk about what beauty there is in our tradition and why we do what we do. Why are we doing this? Because we have belief systems that it's predicated on. Mm-hmm. There's a whole rich tradition of taking care of the deceased so that that is lost, that is being lost. And I don't know how to get the word out in a more gentle, loving manner. Sometimes when you talk to people who want you to not be cremated, it becomes, oh, here's this Orthodox lady telling me not to be cremated. Well, I want to do it. And it becomes a battle versus make your own decisions, but make an educated one. Know what burial is. And I imagine, I would hope that you would then really take it seriously in a way that you might not otherwise. So if you recognize these beliefs that we have, and you could say, I don't believe that. Okay, and maybe you don't. Maybe you could be open to the fact that there's a different way to think about things.
If there's a spark, if they have an idea that they could be I hate to use the word depriving, but I'll use that word, depriving their loved one of the best opportunity, if you believe there's even a spark of what you believe that could be true.
Don't do this.
Why wouldn't you do it for
them? So go with the let's do it versus don't do. Right. So I want to answer your question though, because I think that and many times, oftentimes we'll do a tahara, like even in Israel, the way in which the Chevra Kedisha was engaged after October 7th wasn't intact bodies. Right? And you could say, oh, you know, like we didn't do a proper tahara. We didn't do... I'm telling you, the general theme that was going through our community was, this is the right tahara. This is what this person needed. And I would say the same about any family member up until this point has been taken care of in a certain way. That's what they got. And that was right for them. And God can do anything. You know, like people say to me, well, what about my husband who was cremated? God can do anything. And, you know, we do want to encourage people to be buried because that's the Jewish way. So it's sort of that
like
balance.
It's a wider issue. If we take away the conversation from death to, like, marriage, for example, like, I feel that we're raised to know that if we get married with an Orthodox ketubah,
our children will be halachically Jewish, whereas I don't think everybody is taught that. So kind of the education needs to start mm-hmm. a lot earlier.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So many people I met since I've been living here don't seem to understand that that's the case in Israel. Mm-hmm. Like what works here doesn't yeah. necessarily work in
right.
Israel. But I was brought up to know that if you are not going to get married in an Orthodox.
Yeah. yeah, I guess that's the English system, you know, a little bit. But I,
is it just English? Because that's yeah. the way it works in Israel.
Yeah. I mean, I guess marriages, you can always go back later and get a kosher, you know, get a kosher ketubah.
But
you
it's
could
just
do other
education
things.
Education at that level, right. like, you know, when your right. parents are still young, you kind of.
But it's not even educated in Israel because so many young people are fighting everything that is said to them, right? And so they're not educated either.
Right.
It's really bad.
Right.
I think that some people here are way more educated than the people in Israel. Like, I've said to my nieces and nephews, like, they didn't want to get married by, my niece didn't want to get married by a rabbi. And they just wanted to go wherever. I said, well, what are you going to do for your children? If someone told you today that you could do something today, make sure your child wouldn't have some horrible thing happen to them when they were 30 years from now. If you could take a pill, would you do it? She said, yeah. I said, well, here's your pill. Just do it.
I think there's a resurgence since October 7th. I mean, that's what the world is, the Jewish world is saying. There's a resurgence of people wanting to keep Shabbat or being more connected to their Jewish roots or wanting to go to Israel or wanting to, you know, all these things.
Like,
yes, there's
like
a lack of knowledge. Right.
The beauty of it.
Right.
Yeah.
I have to say, I never had an... My husband was very sick. My husband passed away 18 years ago. He was 43. And he was very ill. And the part of him, you know, we were the first in our community and our friend group and our family to have such a loss at such a young age. He, a couple things I want to say about this. He became so spirit, like when he realized that he knew he was going to die and he took control of that. To stop, you know, the means. He became very spiritual. He became very, it's almost like what you talked about, but in his living days,
yeah.
became
right.
this way that you
right.
hope to become, that
right.
you speak about after it happens.
Right.
He became that way. He
right.
took it upon himself to
right.
be such a force with young families, with young children, because he knew in his own way that his friends were going to have to explain to their young children what happened to St. Andrew. So that was one thing that struck me with what you're saying. The second piece was in his preparing, because, you know, when you have cancer, you don't have control. And this, planning his memorial, for his death, he went to the funeral home. He made his arrangements with his brother. I did not go. I couldn't do it. And he went, and he did it all. He was buried with a shroud. That was very important to him. But I'm sitting here now, 18 years later, and I'm wondering, did we have the other pieces of this?
No, what if he was in shrouds? He probably was taken care of by the Chevra.
Yeah. So I'm thinking
yes.
that he was. I'm going to go home and look
yeah.
at my papers.
He was.
Yes. So I'm thinking that if he had that,
yeah.
then I feel better that he had the other pieces of it, because it probably all goes.
No, I mean,
books
I think
out.
I remember
them.
We brought a suit down for my brother-in-law, and Adam said, we don't do that. We use a shroud. So I imagine
they did
right.
the shroud.
Okay, I feel
like
so much
better.
Yeah.
Knowing that he had the whole
yeah.
trying to go
shebang,
the whole
shebang.
But I didn't know, unless from you sharing, that this is something we have to ask. Like, this is amazing. Like,
right, so we have to talk about it. Like, families don't know about
yeah.
it. That's why I'm on a bit of a mission. If
well,
you want to pick up my book, I have a book. I've described a lot of things, that some of the things I didn't say.
Book.
You're welcome to pick up my book. It's $20. And, you know, you could
know,
even...
Though. We
should know.
They should really offer it. They, we have to...
But in our learning,
they might.
You could do a check into Venmo or Zelle. Venmo, yeah.
Which
interval? What is it?
You can manage. Yeah, give it to the computer.
Oh, so it'll be not anymore. Oh, yes.
You are the one. Exactly.
I said I wanted to show
you. You know, and then I actually
had to. But it's great that you asked for it.
But they got married.
Right.
No, I don't know if I want to keep going. I mean, I've got lots more to talk about, believe me. But you know, like, right. I'm so glad you came. You know, I mean, I think that this is about Jewish education. Writing that book is about educating, but not make a handbook that it's like so dry that nobody's going to actually read it. So you put it into a story, and you say, I didn't know when Sam died. What happened to him? I wanted to know, and here I am 35 years later, and I have some answers that I can let go of him on some level. I'll see you one day. You're fine. And my other kids were like, we grew up in the shadow of death. Okay, great, fine, wonderful. What does that do? It means that you know there's death in the world. You know, it used to be people died at home. There were multi-generationals living together, and people, grandma, great-grandma, or whoever, you know, people died at home, and the great-grandchildren were running around, whatever. However it was more normal. It's not normal anymore, and we put it into the funeral homes, and we don't talk about it, and people don't sit shiva, and yes, it's hard to bury somebody and to go to the grave and put the earth on the coffin, and you hear the thud, and it's actually, perhaps, important, because it's not like we can imagine, like my mother, Alav Hashem, she died a few months after Sam. She was in her 50s when my mother died. Thank you. Venmo I have.
Okay, or could I send a check if you have an address?
Yeah.
He's good for it,
yeah, give it to Gavura. She'll give it to me next time.
Oh, okay. All right, you got it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So when my mother died, what was it saying?
You're about
people being in the home.
Yeah, yeah. So when mummy died, and I went back to her funeral, but I was so broken from Sam dying. This was like too much. And then I came back to America, and I kind of tried to ignore that grief. And actually, I don't know if you know this phrase, God winked. You know, there's a teacher in Jerusalem called Sari Yochevet Rigla. She wrote a book called God Winked.
She's from here.
Right. So she talks about this wink side. So very, very, maybe a few months after Sam died, we were approached by a relative of a young woman who was pregnant and didn't want to have an abortion, and were we interested in adoption. And we didn't know, I had mentioned we had a little infertility, we didn't know, could we have another biological child, and could we have a healthy biological child? We just had one that died. So the chances of having another heart baby are greater. So it was all very unknown what was going to be. We were parents, and then we weren't parents, and I was a mother, but now I'm not a mother, and my baby died. And I'm so sad. And then, the long story is that we ended up adopting this baby. And she was born on the one-year Yahrzeit. Exactly 1 year later, Sophie was born. And we went to the grave to put a headstone on Sam's grave. And then we went to the hospital to pick up our daughter who'd just been born on the same day. And you go like, thank you, Hashem. Yes.
That's a God.
It's in the book.
I haven't read the book yet. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I know all of her kids.
Sophie's my oldest. Sam was the oldest. He was born and died in 1989, and then he died on the second day of Cheshvan, which was like a few weeks ago, right? And then 1 year later, in 1990, on the second day of Cheshvan, Sophie was born.
Unbelievable.
And then,
do you have other children?
Yeah, yes. Thank God I do. Yeah. Actually, one who lives here.
Yeah. Sonia.
How old was she when you adopted her?
She was a baby.
I'm saying
yeah.
That week.
I have a question.
Please.
My parents, thank God, are alive.
Yeah.
My dad is 87 and my mom is 82.
I've met your parents.
Yes, you've met my parents.
Yes.
And
they would like this talk.
They would, but here's my question. So, and I also did not grow up observant. I've been
I'm just
going to
turn this
yes,
off.
Sure, sure,
and
sure.